Libby Price. Great to have you company this early on a Saturday morning. Today on A Country Breakfast, boom, then bust. That seems to be the fate of many country towns whose fortunes ride on the roller coaster of the mining industry.
We've seen the booms and busts, and we're in a bit of a, I must say, reluctantly but honestly, we're probably in a slump now. Possibly the worst slump I've seen in my lifetime. But we all have an innate belief that if we wait long enough, we'll come out of that slump because the commodities are still there.
We'll take you to mining towns across the country to see how communities are riding out that mining roller coaster. Of course, we'll also travel the country with our rural reporters, but before that, what's been making news this week? Tony Allen, how are you this morning?
I'm very well, Libby, and it's no surprise that there's been some pre-budget speculation
only
in rural Australia.
Only 10 more sleeps, Tony.
Yeah, only 10
you
more sleeps.
You and I
sleep.
Both so excited.
Well, if you're a farmer, you'd be keeping a particular eye on the diesel fuel rebate. Now, primary producers, miners too, as well as farmers, currently get a rebate of diesel fuel excise, which equates to about 38 cents a litre. Now, that's quite substantial. This is for diesel used off-road, in other words, on the farm or down the mines, but not on the roads. And the idea of fuel excise was to help pay for roads. So the notion that you get a rebate on your excise is because you're not using it on the public road.
So you get the money back because
yes.
You don't take the vehicles on road.
And it has been mooted that this is one of the things that could be scrapped or cut in the federal budget. Victorian Farmers Federation Peter Toohey says any cuts to the diesel rebate would damage the competitiveness of Australian farm exports.
When the government is talking about trying to make Australian agriculture more competitive, if they increase cost to farmers, it's going to go against what they've promised. So certainly if we have an increase there, it's going to make it very tough on quite a few farmers.
Well, the Deputy Prime Minister Warren Truss was asked about this during the week when he had a speech to the National Press Club. He did say he didn't want to get into the business of confirming or denying anything, but he did give a few hints that he was a supporter of the diesel excise rebate.
But certainly the farm sector in Australia is one of the few in the world that actually pays full price for fuel. It is true that it's been free of excise for a very long period of time, and that's the way we'd like to keep it. We want Australian farmers and indeed Australian industry to be as competitive as we possibly can, and that means keeping costs low for everyone.
If my memory serves me correctly, this seems to come up most budgets, doesn't it, whether or not they might cut the diesel fuel rebate.
Oh, that's right. I guess the thing here is that they have had a commission of audit looking at their spending right across the board, and they are saying substantial cuts have to be made. Mm. So that's why there's more speculation than usual, but we'll have to wait till May the 13th.
Yes, certainly talking tough. Maybe it won't be quite as bad as they're saying it's going to be. Now, this is awkward for the federal government. It came out saying it was going to give drought hit farmers' loans, but it's all gotten into a bit of a mess.
Yes, well, the $280 million worth of concessional loans the federal and state governments offered 2 months ago, they were the centrepiece of the federal government's emergency drought assistance package, are not rolling out yet. They're still stuck in the red tape. Income support payments are already flowing as part of that package, but there's still no agreement between the federal government and the states on how to administer the loans, which means farmers still can't apply for them. And one of the people who's pretty annoyed about this is Charles Burke from the Queensland Farm Lobby Group AgForce.
That is, I guess, the aspect of this that has been a little bit disappointing, in that the federal agriculture minister made this announcement. He worked very hard to get these funds available. It's just unfortunate that we haven't seen it rolled out yet.
Well, certainly unfortunate. And the state agriculture ministers, it's New South Wales and Queensland that are most affected here, say they're still trying to sort out the details, but they're confident of sorting it out. And the Federal Agriculture Minister, Barnaby Joyce, says he's confident of an agreement soon.
My strong belief is that we are very close to a conclusion. Now, if you said weeks or days, no, I would say it's within a month.
Well, the good news is that it has rained and rained aplenty, particularly in the southeast corner of the state. And in fact, some farmers are saying it's the best autumn break they've had in years.
The southern farmers are starting sowing their winter grains, but in the north, as we continually point out, there's still a drought. Northern New South Wales, southern Queensland, and it is coming up to planting time there soon. But Ron Story from Australian Crop Forecasters expects the winter grain plantings, things like wheat, for example, will be down in the north.
They're starting off in a very different situation with low subsoil moistures. The prospect of a dryish winter, because it's a summer rainfall area. And then if you did have the double whammy of another dry year, and particularly a dry spring, that would be devastating. So we're tending to forecast slightly lower than average plantings for those reasons.
Well, last week we heard that the beef and lamb prices are lifting just on the back of all this rain.
Yes, and there's more evidence of that. At the Wangaratta sale yards in northeast Victoria, the prices have increased by about 30 cents a kilo for bullocks and cows in recent weeks. That's very substantial. And they've had more cattle going through the yards at better prices rather than just being sold off because there's not enough feed for them. Sales agent Kevin Sanderson at Wangaratta says it's the best autumn break, the best April rainfall he's seen in at least 20 years.
We'll go into the winter this year for the first time for many with a lot of feed, and that'll carry us right through until the spring, and hopefully, they say El Nino July, August, hopefully September we get the spring rains, and of course we're up and running again, so all looks good.
Finally today, Tony, there's a crackdown on fake flake.
Yes, in news that will cheer fish and chip lovers everywhere. We've had a ruling from, wait for it, the Australian Fish Names Committee. I didn't know there was one, but there is.
No, and I don't think I'm going to volunteer.
The Australian Fish Names Committee has ruled that only two species of shark, gummy shark and rig, can be sold and marketed as flake. Now, currently, in the fish and chip shop or in the supermarket or at the fish markets, flake can pretty much describe any type of shark, and some cheap stuff is coming in from overseas and is being passed off as good quality flake. The Australian Fish Names Committee had been approached by the alliance that represents Southern Australian shark fishermen. They wanted this ruling because they say they needed to boost demand for the local fish, stop people buying this imported cheap rubbish, and get better prices for themselves. Seafood retailer Con Panayiotis from the fish markets in Melbourne says the ruling is going to give customers assurance that they're going to get the best quality eating fish.
A lot of shark comes into the country from overseas. I mean, there's 150, 200 species of shark out there that gets caught. Once it's filleted, not many people can tell. We can tell, but the consumer can't tell what shark is which. So the really good stuff sometimes gets in mixed in with the really cheap stuff, and it all gets passed on as flake, and yeah, that's all about change.
You're a bit of a flake connoisseur, Tony.
Yes, I like flake. I must say, I think the Australian Fish Names Committee hasn't done a great job with such names as Flathead and Orange Ruffy.
Well, the flathead.
They're nice fish.
Yeah, they're beautiful eating.
Not very
and
good
it does
names.
Have a flathead.
It does have a it flathead. Does. I suppose that's quite accurate there.
Tony Allen with this week's Rural News. Rural Reporter is next.
Hello, it's Norman Swan here. You've got to go to RN's website and download the latest edition of our digital magazine, White Paper. This one's on health. You'll find out about the quantified self movement, social media and our health, the biophilia hypothesis and urban development, the controversy around personality disorders, and a feature on Christian morality and its impact on the female body image. That and more. And you know where to head. RN's homepage and look for White Paper.
You're listening to A Country Breakfast on RN. Let's get out and about with our rural reporters. This week, we're tagging the pest fish, the European carp, to track its movements. We dissect a sheep's brain, eel, and go gardening in Australia's hottest town. Boarding school kids are put to work in the school holidays, and we make a pit stop at the Renner Springs Roadhouse. It's just a little dot on the map in the Northern Territory.
It's pretty much the middle of nowhere, so you sort of, no phone service. You get a little bit of internet so you can check yourself in on Facebook if you really must, but that's about the sum of it. But it's an amazing place because you get some real characters through here, you know.
Yeah, and Kelly Taylor is definitely one of them. You'll meet him soon, but first stop today, let's strap on the life vest and head up the Murrumbidgee River to find out the latest strategy to control the spread of European carp.
I saw it go from a wonderfully clear river full of native fish to this brown stained river you see before us today with an underwater environment that would frighten us all if we saw it on land. So full of carp and redfin, gambusia. These species of fish have actually really knocked our native species around quite significantly.
They're known as the rabbits of the waterways, but some people are determined to get rid of them. Hello, I'm Lucy Barber, and I'm on a boat on the Upper Murrumbidgee River, 75 kilometres south of Canberra, near a small town called Bredbow. We're travelling up through a 100 metre high gorge. It's a beautiful, clear autumn morning, and I'm with a group of researchers and scientists from Bush Heritage Australia and the New South Wales Department of Fisheries. They're trying to research and eradicate carp in this river. Peter Saunders is with Bush Heritage Australia.
Well, right in front of us here at the moment is the electrofishing boat, one of the few boats you see in the world which has dangerous high voltage written all over the side of it. And it goes up and down the banks, specifically putting an electronic charge into the river, and that stuns the fish which come up to the surface, which are then netted and caught in a tank. They're measured, weighed, and then if needed, we keep them here. The carp that we're collecting through that process, we're keeping here in a tank, and then we're going to use them as part of our age study to develop a population picture. Yeah, the boat itself has a large generator on it, and that acts, I believe, as the cathode. And the two booms out of the front with the sort of six tentacles on each boom that hang in, they're the anode. So you end up with this large electric circuit developed around the boat, which is why everyone on the boat has wellies and rubber gloves.
Carp are having a devastating effect on the native fish populations in the river. They muddy the water, compete for food, and they also rip up plant life. Steve Samuels has been fishing here since the early 1970s.
You would often see Macquarie perch swimming around in the pools. You would catch them if you targeted them. But also silver perch. We used to have a huge run of silver perch up this river every year. There were lots of golden perch and lots of Murray cod here, but those numbers have thinned out significantly.
Must be pretty upsetting as an angler to see that sort of drastic change.
Well, it is. I mean, as an angler, it's not all about just extracting fish. I mean, a lot of people associate anglers with people that just go and catch and kill fish. That's not necessarily so. A lot of angling nowadays is catch and release. And a lot of angling is just about being in the environment. I mean, some days I'll go fishing on the river and only cast my lure twice because just wandering around having a bit of a look. But when you see the damage that some of these species have done over the 40-odd years I've been here, yeah, it's very, very concerning. And it is very, very sad because we're losing native species. We're losing species that do belong to the environment.
So right now we're in the boat and we're heading up the Upper Murrumbidgee River. And to our left there is the electro boat with the booms off the front of it. The boat is aptly named Lord Voldemort. It's a nice touch. So Prue, you've caught some carp by the looks of it.
Yeah, I've got one adult carp.
He's essentially just been stunned now.
He has, that's right.
That's Prue McGuffey. She's the Senior Fisheries Technician with the New South Wales Department of Primary Industries, and she's hoping that this project will improve the stocks of the endangered Macquarie perch.
Okay, so what we're doing here is electrofishing. We're pulling into the banks, and we've got anodes that are out on big booms heading into the bank that look like big chandeliers without all the lights. And they'll actually put the current into the water, and that will give the fish an involuntary muscle contraction, like swimming, and bring the fish to the surface. Now we're going to net the fish and put it around in the live well where it can recover. So this doesn't actually kill the fish, it's just like putting them to sleep. So then we can collect data like length and weight. 3.5 kilos.
We're back on the riverbank now, and the time has come to dissect some of these carp. It's a bit of a messy job.
So I've pulled the carp out of an ice slurry. So that's used to dispatch of the fish in an ethical way. And now I'm just going to cut into his throat. So I'm going for his otoliths, which are the ear bones in fish. So I'm just getting his gills out of the way now. And I'm just going to break his neck.
Lucky I wore a white jumper.
Now I've got everyone covered in blood, but that's all part of the experience. Okay, so this is the cavity in here I'm trying to get to.
So you've got some fairly heavy-duty secateurs there. It's pretty tough going.
It is. The bones are quite tough. Now I'm just going to go in a bit deeper. Okay, so I've got one here. It's the otolith. So that's got like a tree. It's each year the fish puts down a new growth on it and we can use it to age the fish. So that'll be sent away and we'll be given an age in years of the fish. It's a milky white bony structure and you can see on the bigger fish the rings, again, like the tree stump.
That was tiny. It was a bit like finding a needle in a haystack.
It is, yes, definitely. They're not very big and you've got to break into the bone at the back of the skull and it's quite, there's a lot of blood and guts in there too.
And then what sort of data can you take from that in the long run? What will this eventually tell you about the fish?
This tells us the population structure. So we'll know what years were good years when there were lots of carp spawned that actually recruited into the population. And we also can find out how old the oldest fish are and what size, so the condition of the fish compared to how old they are as well.
If you were worried at all that the carp that gets collected goes to waste, don't be. Local farmer Lawrence Koenig has come along today and he's going to be taking all the dead carp away to spread over his pastures.
Today's carp will go in a 1,000-litre tank with water and over about 2 or 3 months it'll fall apart. The meaty skin bones fall to the bottom and up the top you've got a really nice, smelly, delicious, for the soil, that is, brew.
Yeah, well, it's in the pretty much the middle of nowhere, I suppose. It's quite funny because people say, where the hell are you? And basically we're halfway between Darwin and Alice Springs. No phone service. You get a little bit of internet so you can check yourself in on Facebook if you really must, but that's about the sum of it. But it's an amazing place because you get some real characters through here, you know? And most of them work here.
And roadhouse worker Kelly Taylor is certainly one of them, a character. Hello, I'm Carmen Brown at the Renner Springs Roadhouse, a unique watering hole on the highway about 160 kilometres north of Tennant Creek in the Northern Territory. And what makes it so unique? Well, it could have something to do with the hundreds of hats, caps and visors which hang from every available space behind the bar.
Actually, I tried to count them last year and I got up to 863. I think it started back in there. I think you're flying towards the back of the bar by the pig on the wall. There's a hat there from about 2000, I think, if you can see out there. I think it's when the hats started getting collected and people just sort of sign them and drop them off. There's a couple of famous ones last year. If you look at the front over there, there's the owners of Americane, the winner of the Melbourne Cup the year before came through here and they dropped off the hat and signed it for us. So lots of people dropping some different stuff.
Now, there's a bit of room still on the roof for a few more hats, so I assume this collection is only going to grow. But do you have a favourite one that's hanging up there?
Oh, no, actually, my favourite one's back over here. I've worn it quite a few times, actually. Just last week, I had a bit of a party in here. We had a little Japanese girl working here, and she thought it was very funny.
It's an Asian-style hat, I think.
Yeah,
it is.
I think it's from Vietnam. Someone dropped it in. Our cook's actually... His girlfriend's from Jakarta and some friends of them came and sort of dropped it off and stuff. But I've taken it off and I'm wearing it around the bar. Yeah, it's quite fun, eh?
So what sort of work is it that you actually do here behind the bar and at the roadhouse in general?
I suppose it's sort of more like for my job it's more like a guest relations side of thing because people come in there and, you know, they can be here and they'll sit at the bar and they can be the only person here. So you sort of got to half entertain them and sort of find out a lot where they're from. But for me it's so different because I've got one story and my story is pretty simple, but I get to hear 50 or 60 stories of people that come through a day, so it's quite different to where I usually work, you know. So, I mean, I work on the Gold Coast and Byron Bay for years, and to come out here, it's just so unique and so different. It's quite funny, but you get a lot of old truckers come through here too, you know, like old boys that have been doing this for years up and down the sort of Stuart Highway route from Darwin to Adelaide, and they can get quite eccentric and quite funny. Thank you, ladies.
Thank you very much, Tommy.
No worries.
Now, you're a Kiwi. You've been here, this is your second stint here. Why do you keep coming back?
I think it's just the uniqueness of the place and the eccentricities of the place. It's amazing. I mean, for me, I remember last year I turned up and I'd been travelling around and I sort of stopped for a night and ended up here for 5 months. But I did save a lot of money and I did lose weight out here. So it's sort of like a rehab where you can sort of save money and get away from it all, because you can't spend it out here. There's nowhere to spend it.
Well, it is a bit of a trap though, isn't it, for some places like this where you work, you earn some money and then you spend the rest of it on the other side of the bar.
Yeah. You can tend to do that. A lot of people sort of finish work and don't sort of find their way back to their room, you know, or halfway back. But, you know, I suppose that's part of it all as well. You know, people come out here and the uniqueness of it all sort of gets involved, you know.
What does a typical day involve for you?
Oh, for me? Like, I'll probably get up about 8 or 9 o'clock and I'll go for a walk down the road, because I sort of quite look around. I put my music on and go for a little wander, and then I'll come back and go for a swim in the pool out the back there and have some lunch and just check some emails and a bit of TV, read a book, maybe watch a DVD, and then I come to work. That's pretty much what it is. And then I'll finish about 10 o'clock and I'll sometimes go back to bed, or if there's people around, have a drink and laugh. And same thing, you know. But there's always someone different to talk to, and there's so much different stuff going on, you just don't know.
We're sort of on the edge of the tourist season. I imagine it's about to get pretty busy here. What will life be like when that happens?
Well, it's funnily enough, I wasn't here for the busy season last year, but I heard all about it. You get a lot of the, I think they call them grey nomads, a lot of the older people come through, and apparently they're pretty hard work, so I'm looking forward to sort of trying to control them. But yeah, I mean, for me it's going to be different, because I did the quiet season, and the busy season is going to be a lot different for me. I probably won't be able to hack it.
I think Kelly and the team at Renner Springs are going to have a great season with those grey nomads moving through. Still to come on Rural Reporter today, school holiday fun in the shearing shed and the challenges of gardening in Australia's hottest town. But now we're off on a field day in Western Victoria, where a vet is giving a very graphic demonstration on the best way to ensure a sheep flock is free of the deadly brain disease, scrapie. And a warning, some listeners may find this story rather disturbing.
Normally I do it on the ground. So that should be a little more stable now. So the brain of a sheep isn't the biggest thing in the world. It's about that big, and it sits mostly in here.
It's probably something you shouldn't look at if you're at all squeamish. In front of me, a lamb's head is being dissected, and the aim is to retrieve the brain intact so it can be tested for deadly diseases. G'day, I'm Brett Worthington at Horsham in Western Victoria, where District Veterinary Officer Dr. Amy Sluggett has armed herself with an axe, a mallet, a long knife and a saw to get the job done.
We can look at the brain itself, we can look for swellings, we can look for lumps and bumps and scar tissue, but we also most commonly fix them in formalin and send them down to our pathologist. And one of the reasons that we do that is they look for transmissible spongiform encephalopathies, which, if you put it simply, is mad cow disease. It doesn't always happen in cows, it's also been known to happen in sheep. And we need to prove to the rest of the world, so we can maintain trade markets, that we're free of this disease. So this whole front nose section, I can pretty much whack as hard as I want, and it's not going to hurt a hell of a lot. The only problem is an axe won't go through wool, and it won't go through skin very well.
So how regular is this, would brains be sent away? Is it, are we talking like be happening weekly, or is it a monthly type thing?
Around the state, I couldn't say. But within the northwest region, we would be looking at sending one every week to 2 weeks.
And that's just so you can maintain, just to show that it's virus-free, pest-free, kind of, you can maintain that status?
Yeah. We do a lot of things to exclude disease so that we can prove to people that we're free of certain things that they don't want brought into their country.
And so what should farmers be looking out for? Like, what should be sending an alarm bell in your head saying, I should probably get someone from the department out here to have a look at my sheep, and maybe we might need to send a brain away?
Just in general, not specifically for mad cow disease, we would say anything that's out of the ordinary. And it doesn't have to be dramatic all the time. Sometimes you might just look back at your figures and think, wow, I've lost a lot more ewes this year than normal, or maybe my lambs aren't doing as well. And it ranges right up to the really dramatic. So you might walk out into your paddock one day, you've moved them the day before onto a fresh stubble, and all of a sudden you've got 20 sheep lying on the ground dying. And I mean, that's something that really does ring alarm bells, and you should be ringing us or your private vets. Brain removal is best left for the vets, mostly because there is the potential to damage the brain as you take it out. We're working with an axe and a mallet on bone that's sort of 4 or 5 millimetres thick, and if you happen to hit too hard or get a bit enthusiastic, you can ruin your entire sample.
Because you've got quite substantial gear here that we're looking at. We've got a little bit of axe and a hammer and quite a big knife. I see you've got steel cap boots on, obviously. Is it at all fearful that, you know, you might catch a finger at all?
Look, there's always the worry that one day you'll slip, but we do quite a lot of training and we learn quite a lot of really good knife skills and ways not to hurt ourselves.
I'm standing in Australia's hottest town, or at least that's what the locals reckon. Between October 1923 and April 1924, the mercury hovered above 100 degrees Fahrenheit for 160 consecutive days here, setting a world record. G'day, I'm Lucy Bell, and I'd like to welcome you to the town of Marble Bar in Western Australia's Pilbara region. And despite the heat haze creating ripples in the red hills behind me, I'm actually feeling quite cool because I'm standing in the shade of green branches at Outback Trees. It's a native nursery here, and Clive has offered to show me around.
Okay, we've got currajongs, boabs, desert oaks. We've probably got fairly close to 400 ground plants that we water every day in the nursery. And we've probably got about 25,000 plants in the nurseries.
And all of them native to this neck of the woods?
90% of them would be, yeah.
The Outback Trees Nursery is the brainchild of Dennis O'Meara. He moved to Marble Bar in 1959 to work for the Department of Mines. And he would later establish this place as a prospecting base and somewhere to propagate all the beautiful flora that he came across in the desert. Most of the plants here are grown from seeds he collected himself in the bush.
Now, this is Dennis's desert garden. Roughly, it's about 3 years old now, I think. But all different sorts of plants.
So we're standing on some beautiful Marble Bar red dirt, and we're looking around the garden, and there's a beautiful array of trees. What are some of the things we can see here, Clive?
We've got the white dragonflower. We've got the green bird flower. We have the boomerang tree or the chinterbell. We've got eucalypts. We've just about got everything that's out in the bush we've got in here that Dennis has planted, yeah.
And considering that we're in the hottest town in Australia, I have to say it's quite cool in this garden.
It is beautiful, actually, yeah.
Do you think people are a bit surprised to hear that there's this little native tree nursery tucked away?
A lot of people don't know it's here, and they are very surprised when they find out. And we take great pleasure, actually, in showing people around.
While most of the plants, trees and shrubs here are destined for mine landscaping projects, local station owners and home gardeners are welcome too.
Just making a bit of a garden around a new house.
What about a...
I've got a row of those hibiscus in there.
Like a mulga or something like that?
Yeah, a bit of a mulga.
A lot of the trees here, they go out onto the mine sites and they do the landscaping around the villages and stuff like that. What happens is we get them up here, the trees up here, all the plants up here, we harden them up before they go out onto the jobs.
Almost like an acclimatisation stopover before they head to the mine sites.
That's right.
And apart from the miners, do you get a lot of customers from the stations? You got Annabelle from Yarri here today picking up a few trees.
Dennis has given away lots and lots of plants in his lifetime. He gives away a lot. We supply trees to the townspeople free of charge. We don't charge them whatsoever. Dennis won't let us charge them.
It's a bit of a community project, really, greening Marble Bar a bit. And what's your favourite, Clive, of all the trees here?
I like the desert oak most of all, yes, which is this one here. This one here.
Oh, wow.
It's an oak. I've seen it out, quite a few of them, big stands of them, out at Rudal River. Grow to about probably 50 foot high.
It almost has sort of needles like you'd see on a Christmas tree rather than leaves.
It does, yeah. People I show this to, they've often said, oh, that'd make a nice Christmas tree.
I can imagine a nice sort of line of these, you know, on either side of a driveway leading up to a station. It looks very regal and very sort of prim and proper amongst all the other sort of scragglier looking trees.
Yeah, it is. Beautiful tree.
There isn't much rest for the council kids during the Easter break. Like many school children home from boarding school for the holidays, they've been put to work helping out in the shearing shed. Hello, I'm Lydia Burton on the council's property Dunblane near Barcaldine in western Queensland. They've got 400 head of sheep to shear in this mob over the next couple of days, so it's all hands on deck.
Big way.
While Dad, David Council, is busy in the drafting yards, the kids have got their special jobs to do.
Hi, I'm Lily and I'm 8 years old.
What have you been doing today, Lily?
We've been shearing.
What's been your job?
To sweep up after the shearers and to pick up wool.
Do you think many of your friends at school ever get to get in a shearing shed?
No.
Why do you think that's special?
Because no one else has really experienced this.
Hi, my name's Fenella and I am 10 years old. My job was to sweep up wool after the shearers have shorn the sheep.
Do you like getting in the shearing shed and working with the family?
Yeah, it's quite fun.
Hi, my name's Monty and I'm 12 years old. I've been helping Dad in the race and skirting the wool.
And how are you feeling right now?
I'm tired.
What's been the favourite part of your day?
The breaks.
When you go back to school, how do you describe to your friends what you were doing over the holidays?
Well, it's pretty hard because they haven't actually experienced it and they don't really get it. So, yeah, it's pretty hard.
And do you think they'd find it exciting? What do you think they would think of doing this kind of thing?
I think they'd find it a bit weird, but they'd also enjoy it.
It's not just the council kids who are working here at Dunblane during the holidays. Local boys Harley McCalman and Cooper Wheeler are here too, helping out the shearing team.
Hi, my name's Harley and I'm 8.
And Harley, what have you been doing today?
Shearing with Bopper and the rest.
And what's been your job today?
Mainly getting sheep out for them and picking up wool.
What's been the favourite part of your job?
Taking down the sheep.
Now, are you on school holidays, Harley?
Yes.
Which is harder, school or working in the shearing shed?
I think working in the shearing shed.
Hi, I'm Cooper and I'm 11.
And Cooper, what have you been doing today?
Well, mainly grabbing the sheep and taking them to the shearers and picking up wool.
And what's the process of what happens in the shearing sheds? What happens?
Well, us kids grab them, take them to the shearers, they shear them, and then they'll take them down to the chute, and then the wool will go onto a table and be processed and be sold.
And I asked Harley, but which is harder, going to school or working in the shearing shed?
School.
11-year-old Cooper Wheeler ending that story on holiday shearing from Lydia Burton on Dunblane Station in western Queensland. And I hope he's not finding school too hard now the holidays are over. You can check out the action in the shearing shed by going online. abc.net.au/rural. This is a Country Breakfast. My name's Libby Price. Coming up, country towns riding out the mining boom and inevitable bust.
What's all the noise about?
The drum is coming to ABC One.
It's the perfect place to discuss the big issues.
Are these the real issues?
And some not so big ones.
We go beyond the headlines.
Pulling apart the news of the day.
I think he's only just getting warmed up.
With guests who may surprise you.
And some familiar faces.
Nothing is off limits.
It's the news from every angle.
Join us for The Drum.
The Drum, from May 5th at 5:30 on ABC One, following the early edition news.
Boom, then bust. That seems to be the fate of many country towns whose fortunes ride on the roller coaster of the mining industry. The crest of the boom means high-paying jobs, new infrastructure, a prospering community, and a real estate market ripe for investment. But when the bust comes, populations inevitably decline and businesses close as commodity prices go down and jobs dry up. Now, for many communities, a change in international commodity markets can kickstart a fresh boom and the cycle begins again. ABC Rural paid a visit to a handful of mining towns to find out how the locals manage to ride the ups and downs. First, let's go to Western Australia. And ever since prospector Paddy Hannon found gold there in 1894, Kalgoorlie has been synonymous with the precious metal and lots of it. But high costs of production, low commodity prices, and little to no investment has meant the shine has disappeared from the industry over the past 12 months. Tara de Landgraaf reports.
It's one of the biggest downturns in living memory. Jobs are being cut, mines are closing, and local businesses are suffering. But the gold mining town of Kalgoorlie-Boulder, 600 kilometres east of Perth, has seen it all before. And everyone here is holding on tight to the roller coaster that is gold mining, knowing that at some stage it'll be on the way back up. Someone who's seen the incredible highs and the depths of the low is Kalgoorlie local Doug Dawes. He used to work at the iconic Super Pit, a gold mine so big it can be seen from space. I'm standing here with Doug, looking out over that massive mine at the Super Pit lookout. Doug, how do you deal with such a boom-bust cycle of life?
When we talk about the ups and downs of the mining industry, I've been involved in it because I've worked, lived here and did schooling and worked here all my life. So inevitably I've seen it go through many phases. Indeed, I was the chief geological draftsman on this very mine when it was all closed down in 1978 and we all lost our jobs. We've seen the booms and busts, and we're in a bit of a, I must say, reluctantly but honestly, we're probably in a slump now. Possibly the worst slump I've seen in my lifetime. But the town is still growing, and there's a worry, I don't say a fear, a worry that the slump might go on for longer, and it probably will, but we all have an innate belief that if we wait long enough, we'll come out of that slump because the commodities are still there. But that's the nature of the beast in a mining town. It's always been so. But we're all brave enough and knowledgeable enough to know that it won't last forever. And for those people that come in and commit and buy properties or businesses while we're down, reap the benefits later on.
Well, I've left the Super Pit on the outskirts of town and now I'm on Hannon Street, Kalgoorlie's main thoroughfare. There's mud-splattered four-wheel drives angle-parked on one of the widest streets in Australia. Men and women in fluoro, orange, high-vis clothing are buying their lunch or nipping into the bank. But there's a lot less cars and a lot less people than there used to be. And someone who's crunched the numbers is local accountant and publican Ashok Parekh. Ashok, how does this downturn compare to what you've seen before?
This would be the toughest business environment in 30 years in Kalgoorlie. You know, when we advise a couple of hundred businesses, you see what's going on. There has been a big downturn, particularly in the last 12 months in Kalgoorlie, in the service industry, which is really reflective of the reduction in the commodity prices of nickel and gold and a reduction in funding by overseas institutions and money being available to companies to spend in Kalgoorlie.
That downturn in the mining industry, how is that affecting mum and dad businesses in town?
So it's reflected in all businesses. I would say in the last 12 months that the most businesses are down in turnover by about 20%. So that is very, very tough in this environment. And it's reflected in the reduction of jobs in Kalgoorlie. And people have laid off staff and it's pretty difficult times.
Well, while there are plenty of people leaving Kalgoorlie in this downturn, it's not a one-way street. Some have come here to make it their new home, like Brendan Simpson. Brendan, you picked up your family and brought them here last year at a time when the town was literally booming. It's always a tricky time. What was behind your thinking making the move back then?
Kalgoorlie ticked a lot of boxes in terms of us moving out here, three young couples and looking to have a family. Yeah, there was lots of stuff that sort of appealed to us, and we thought, yeah, why not? Let's get out and see what happens in Kalgoorlie.
Now, you bought 12 months ago, and the economic fortunes of the community have really changed since then. Tell us a bit about the last 12 months.
I think diversify is probably the best word that springs to mind for me. Obviously, yeah, the business that we researched and looked into had been operating during boom time. Luckily and thankfully to all most of the clients that we inherited when we got the business, they've been able to maintain contracts and they've maintained their trust with us and upkept their end of the deal. And it has had to change. We've had to diversify. Hence, we've gone more down the restaurant side of things.
In hindsight, was it a good idea to buy in the boom and then, I suppose, weather the downturn?
Hindsight's probably a beautiful thing. If you look back, would you want to? Possibly not. Obviously, I think everyone sort of knew that there may have been a bit of a slump coming, and being in Kalgoorlie now for 12 months, we've heard about every 7 years, as they talk about every 7 years, it seems to take a little bit of a hit. We've managed to get through, survive, and we're all still talking after 12 months, so yeah, diversify, just get along with it, and yeah, you put in the hard yards and hopefully it'll bounce back soon.
Now, despite its boom-bust history, the mines of Kalgoorlie, Boulder and the Goldfields region in general have a strange and alluring pull for many people. People like Neil Della, who's worked in mining his whole life, just like his father before him. Now he's the maintenance superintendent at the Lakewood Gold Processing Facility, which sits in the shadows of the Superpit waste dump on the edge of town, which is where we're standing right now. Neil, it's dirty, it's dusty, and yet you're very proud to call yourself a miner from Kalgoorlie.
Very, very proud to call myself a miner, but more proud to call myself a Kalgoorlie boy. I still reckon, you know, Goldfields pioneered the mining industry, and yeah, I'm really proud about that. And it sort of instilled into my boys as well.
We know that the industry is going through a bit of a slump at the moment. Do you see that here on site, or can you feel it here on site?
Oh, you don't feel it on site, because basically what it's done is the locals from Kalgoorlie, you know, we've seen it before, we're all still here, we stick. We'll be here through the tough times, the good times. It's a volatile industry, you know. How can you predict what's around the corner? Like, 18 months ago we were flying and we're still here. Don't worry, we won't go anywhere. Like, Kalgoorlie is the backbone of WA as far as I'm concerned. You know, it'll turn, don't worry about that. And as I said, the true Goldfields will be here.
Neil Della from Silver Lake's Lakewood Processing Facility near Kalgoorlie, ending that report by Tara de Landgraft. Let's head southeast now to Tasmania, where gold put Beaconsfield on the map, but tragedy and dark tourism are keeping it there. A small earthquake on the 25th of April 2006 triggered a rockfall that killed a miner, Larry Knight, and trapped two others in a tiny void a kilometre below the surface for 2 weeks. On the 9th of May, it seemed like the whole world was watching the dramatic rescue of miners Brant Webb and Todd Russell. Penny Terry and Rose Grant prepared today's boom and bust Beaconsfield report.
There isn't a person that doesn't come in and say something about that and ask questions. Yeah, it's a draw card. And, of course, it has been replaced a little bit by the museum and how fantastic that is. Somebody said to me once, we're a town with a mine in it, we're not a mining town. And I thought that's actually correct.
Beaconsfield cafe owner Joe Kennedy is catering to locals and tourists alike. On this busy main street of the small country town, there's more than the usual buzz. Beaconsfield's just held its first literary festival, called the Festival of Golden Words. And with more than 80 authors on the program, it's Tasmania's biggest literary event this year. When David Parker came from Western Australia to Beaconsfield in the 1980s, he said it was a town that time forgot.
It was a place people didn't want to be. I mean, local families, they were all very happy. Nothing had changed for a long period of time. The mine had been shut. There wasn't a lot of work. People were travelling to work. That was it. It was just very quiet. There was the two supermarkets, but they were very small. They were smaller than the coffee. One of them was smaller than the coffee shop, and that was the supermarket. It was just really quiet.
Beaconsfield's booms have been brief, but the gleam from gold has been bright. The area was responsible for Australia's first iron ore exports in 1806. But the discovery of Australia's richest gold reef really put Beaconsfield on the map. From 1877 until early Federation, the area really prospered with riches from its famous Tasmania Reef. Local historian and writer Nigel Birch says the main reef is what's called a transverse fault, and it erupted from the nearby Cabbage Tree Hill.
It was incredibly rich. The first major discovery, they said that the gold was erupting out of the ground in quartz, and it was like blackberries on the bush, looking at this quartz with the gold studded through it. And the bloke who discovered it, William Daly, was extraordinarily generous, and people who came along, he told them, just break off a piece and keep it. He was quite happy to give it away.
The reef, Australia's richest, averaged 20 grams of gold a tonne, but by 1914 the mine had shut and remained closed for the next 80 years. It wasn't till the advent of the 1991 Gulf War that gold prices revived and investors seeking a safe haven found one again in Beaconsfield. At its peak, the mine was crushing 5,000 tonnes of ore a week. It was recovering between 2,000 and 3,000 ounces of gold and making $1 million to $1.5 million a week. The light from the Beaconsfield gold mine was shining bright and did so until in April 2006, three miners were caught in a rockfall a kilometre underground. It took 2 weeks for two of them to be rescued in May 2006. The Australian government then provided an $8 million fund to help the mine and its employees adjust to any closure, and almost $1 million from the fund went to the town's Heritage Museum, which is now the region's biggest tourist attraction, with 45,000 visitors a year. Small business and tourist ventures also saw opportunities to tap the potential of Beaconsfield's dark and golden past. Joe Kennedy bought the cafe in the main street of Beaconsfield in 2010, but by the end of 2011, the mine's owner, BCD Resources, had announced it was closing the mine.
It was maybe a year after I started, and I was a bit concerned, but even in the main street, the council's actually spent a lot of money on giving it a beautification, and I think the people themselves have just gone, yeah, we can do this, and everyone's just jumped in, and I think that's uplifting.
Joe Kennedy from Beaconsfield's Two Doors Cafe. Let's head to Queensland now, and it was a boom like no other in resource-rich Moranbah, 200 kilometres west of Mackay, where even a community purpose-built for mining couldn't keep up with the extraordinary demands that peaked in 2011. And now China's appetite for coal has slowed, prices have fallen sharply, and the downturn's caught many by surprise. Interstate investors unfamiliar with the mining cycle have been left reeling, but some long-time residents say they're happy to get back to normal. As Susanna Baker reports from the central Queensland town, the community split on the benefits of the boom and the real cost of the bust.
It's busy in the town square. The car parks are nearly full. Women are pushing prams and small children follow close behind. On the surface, Moranbah is a bustling place full of families and workers driving their utes in and out of town. Walking by the real estate windows, though, the number of houses and rental properties available tell a different story of the town's changing fortunes. During the boom time, real estate was big business, and John Wood was a man in high demand.
Phones were ringing 24 hours a day, and obviously, yeah, it was a time where there's a lot of commissions, a lot of sales, so yeah, it was good for the short time it lasted.
As the demand for coal tumbled, so too did the demand for property. It also sent shockwaves through the mining workforce as jobs started to be cut. In the past 2 years, 8,000 jobs have gone from the Queensland mining and resource sector alone. And that's shaken confidence in bricks and mortar in towns like Moranbah.
There's not much sales. A few of the sales that are going through are to owner-occupiers. Obviously, you know, with the price realistic to the market, we are selling a few there. But investors, no, we haven't got many investors looking at the moment. So the phones are very quiet.
In the peak demand time, a new four-bedroom home could have commanded $1 million. That's come back by as much as 40% in some cases. An older-style home might set you back $300,000 now. That's half the money people were paying only 2 years ago. Interstate investors in particular have been caught out.
I believe that there is some people that are in financial hardship, but obviously, you know, some people are still managing with what they have at the moment and their commitments. We haven't had a lot of foreclosures that I'm aware of in Murrumburra at the present time.
At one of the local pubs in the early afternoon, there's no shortage of patrons. A group of older mine workers talk shop in the corner, and at a nearby table, a couple of drive-in, drive-out contractors enjoy a beer on a day off. But uncertainty about the future isn't far from their minds.
Yeah, there's not really much job security here.
Damien Huxham's home is a nine-hour drive away at Hervey Bay. He's an operator at one of Queensland's newest coal mines. But his contract is quickly running out and he's only got another month to find more work.
Yeah, it's the nature of the industry. You've got to be prepared to jump in and take things and try and stick them out as long as you can and see what other opportunities there are. But you're always looking.
He's been looking for a permanent job, but at the moment, they're hard to come by.
You've got to keep your eye out on Seek every day, sending resumes out. That's the industry.
Back in the town square, with all the talk of doom and gloom in mining, a shiny sign out the front of a brand new business seems out of place.
I've taken the risk, put my money where my mouth is and jumped in, and we're now coming up to our third month in business. And so far it's been going, okay, it can do a lot of things better, and we're ready for that to happen if and when it happens.
Steve Hanvey has reopened the bakery after it closed down late last year.
I see businesses around doing it a bit tough. I speak with a lot of business owners and they are doing it tough with this fly-in, fly-out. If the camps where these fly-in, fly-out people were, if they were just allowed to spend their money locally again to get the businesses back into a buoyant situation where they could start re-employing people here, it would make the town much more viable. At the moment, we're just not getting enough out-of-town money coming into the businesses to assist in that area.
Anne Baker's the mayor of the Isaac region, where Moranbah is the biggest town. The local government area is as big as Tasmania and is home to 29 of Queensland's 56 mines.
What goes out of our area to the state runs the state and runs the country.
She says the mining industry will turn around. It always does. But there's a bigger threat to Moranbah's future.
The biggest change that we are all, everyone is seeing and we're all very well aware is the 100% fly-in, fly-out work practice.
During the downturn, two new coal mines have come online. They're within driving distance from town, yet no locals work there. Mining company BMA says it deliberately set out to target a workforce to fly in, fly out from Cairns or Brisbane. This was at a time when there was a shortage of skilled workers. Mayor Baker says FIFO is an accepted part of the mining landscape because Moranbah couldn't cope with every employee living locally. But she says 100% FIFO is affecting Moranbah's growth.
It affects your schools, education, health, your small business. It affects everything. For long-term sustainability, there has to be population renewal. And with a work practice, 100% fly-in, fly-out, where there's no choice and there's no balance, that equals no population renewal.
Away from the political debate, one woman will tell you there's nothing to be worried about. For over 42 years, Linny Busk has called Moranbah home. She's on grandma duties at her place in the newly developed part of town.
It might be quieter times, but if you go uptown, you'll still see there's people still having coffee and there's still mums pushing their prams and there's children still going to school and there's more new families moving into town every day. And that's exciting. I'm finding it a little sad because I go to the supermarket at the moment and I don't recognise some of the people and you get this sort of blank stare back at you. But I'll bet in a couple of years' time, if these people just stick it out in Moranbah, they'll be smiling back at us too.
That's Linny Busk from Moranbah in central Queensland, ending Susanna Baker's report on the mining downturn. Well, that's it for today. If you'd like to take a look at some of the photographs or read some more of the news, perhaps just listen back to a podcast of the program, just head to our website, abc.net.au/rural. Great to have your company this morning, and thank you to our technical producer, John Jacobs. On RN, I'm Libby Price. Talk to you next week on A Country Breakfast.